From Miami Law, I'm Annette Uguez, and this is The Explainer.
Victims of gender-based violence, as many people say, are subject to gender-based punishment. Our criminal legal system doesn't understand the realities of survivors. And as a result, we see survivors criminalized.
Welcome back to the Miami Law Explainer, the legal affairs podcast where Miami law experts lend context and historical relevance to today's headlines. U.S. laws inadequately address violence in domestic abuses cases. Today on our show, Caroline Bettender Lopez, who led the Obama and Biden administration's efforts to address gender-based violence, joins us to talk about where we've been and where we're going. Let's go to executive producer Catherine Skip with the interview.
Good morning, Carrie.
Good morning.
It's so great to have you on.
Great to be here. Thank you.
Thank you. So Elizabeth Flock wrote a piece recently in the Washington Post on domestic violence. In it, she cited a study that found that women are twice as likely as men to be convicted of a crime claiming self-defense, and the odds for Black women are even worse. Can we just start there?
Sure. Her piece really points out a phenomenon that many of us know, but is not recognized in our criminal legal system. It's not recognized in society, which is that victims of gender-based violence, as many people say, are subject to gender-based punishment. Our criminal legal system doesn't understand the realities of survivors. And as a result, we see survivors criminalized. And the vast majority of women who are incarcerated have experienced intimate partner violence, sexual violence, or other forms of gender-based violence in their lifetimes.
Mm. Could you talk a little about your work with the Obama administration and the newer work with President Joe Biden? Your work was aimed not at domestic, as in U.S., I mean, but also in global efforts, correct?
Yeah. So my work as a women's human rights lawyer over the past 20 or so years has been really shaped by my formation in international human rights law. And so for me, connecting the dots between our work in global spaces on violence against women and gender-based violence and our work in our domestic context in the United States, it's absolutely essential. It's essential that we practice what we preach in terms of what we tell the other world they should be doing to protect women or prevent violence. And it's important that we can learn lessons from with humility from our world partners and other countries and advocates and survivors all around the world. And so for me, connecting those dots, kind of making sure that we as a country are doing the work on the global stage that is both humble and learning from others, as well as offering our lessons learned in conversation and collaboration, is critically important. So that's been kind of a guiding principle for me in my work when I worked as the advisor on violence against women in the White House in the Obama administration. And then I just came off a 2-year position at the Department of Justice, where I served as the senior advisor on gender and equality.
And in both of those positions, you created reports, you know, kind of laying out, especially, I think if I read it right, a lot of U.S. domestic problems that need to be addressed.
Mm-hmm.
What were those sort of big things domestically that need to be done in the United States?
Sure. Well, during the Obama administration, I took on several portfolios that had already been built up and then was able to kind of dig deeper into a few. One was focused on campus sexual assault and on the evolving nature of Title IX, which prohibits sex discrimination in federally funded educational institutions. And so I worked a lot on the issue of sexual assault in educational environments, and especially on college and university campuses. I also focused on the issues of violence against Indigenous women in the United States, as well as in North America, and helped to form a working group on violence against Indigenous women in North America that involved the governments of Canada, US, and Mexico. I worked on thinking about kind of how we can go about serving survivors and getting the criminal justice system to respond better to survivors who were either seeking the assistance of the criminal justice system or who were involved in it in some way, as well as starting to explore what we call alternative pathways to safety for survivors who don't want to engage in the criminal legal system for some of the reasons that we just talked about at the very beginning of the show.
Right. Your later work isn't just involved with women. I know that was kind of the title, you know, violence against women, but you're really focusing on all groups that are survivors of intimate partner violence, gender-based violence. It's a bigger bucket, no?
Right. The terminology is changing, both on the world stage and in the United States. And it's something that, you know, as the terminology evolves, we have to kind of think about all of the different manifestations and ramifications of that. But the term gender-based violence is the term that I have advocated, and I think many are now kind of tending towards, to be a little bit more widely encompassing of the experiences of people with violence that is motivated by gender or sex, that is based on some sort of discrimination against an individual on the basis of their sex or gender, or gender identity, sexual orientation, or characteristics. Mm-hmm. And so what the United States kind of recently put forward last May in 2023, the White House issued a national plan to end gender-based violence. And that was the first ever national plan, something that around 80 other countries around the world have done. And so we've now joined that group. We learned from many other countries, including South Africa, Australia, Uruguay, Finland, and Spain, and many other countries, and listening sessions and engagements with governments and advocates in those countries. And ultimately, this term gender-based violence was the term that was used. There's now also in this administration, a senior advisor on gender-based violence in the White House. And so whereas my position was senior advisor on violence against women in the White House, the terminology has shifted to include not only violence against women, but to, again, kind of embrace the fact that people, you know, across the gender spectrum and across society experience gender-based violence, intimate partner violence, sexual violence, forms of stalking, forms of coercive control, and other interconnected forms of violence. We do know that women and LGBTQI plus people experience these forms of violence at significantly higher rates. But men and boys do experience it as well. And so we wanted to make sure to kind of bring everybody under the tent.
Perfect. So Flock's piece primarily focused on women being abused by their partners, but we were just talking about how much wider the problem is. What are the most pressing needs? Either state legislation, laws change, Congress, like, it seems like there's a lot of stuff left to be done. Kind of, if you had the, you know, your top three wish list, where would you start? With state legislatures, with Congress, like, how to protect everybody in the same way so that you don't have more women, you know, serving time for something that you wouldn't have if you were a man.
Right. I think the most important place to start with any sort of kind of policy or legislative work is to think about, is to start with survivors and communities, and to ask the question and to listen, earnestly listen to what they've identified as the ways in which they think they can be most safe. I don't think that policymakers do that enough. And we impose systems on people rather than creating systems that serve the needs of people and the evolving needs. So when we were developing the national plan to end gender-based violence over the past few years, we engaged in about 25 listening sessions with over 2,000 advocates and survivors and experts. And what we continually heard were a few messages. Number one, that economic and housing security was paramount, and that many survivors stay because of economic reasons. And no order of protection or immigration consequences or criminal, criminal consequences for their abusive partners are going to make them safer, they say. It might make them safer in kind of some sort of immediate moment or not. But when they look at kind of the short, medium, and the long term, they are looking for a way to make themselves safe. And there's organizations out there, an organization like Free From, for example, that has conducted, that is composed of survivors, connected to survivors. They've done surveys of survivors who have said that to keep themselves safe, they, on average, the average survivor who responded to these surveys needed around $950. That's what they determined they needed to keep themselves safe, whether that was paying for that car repair they needed or that month of, you know, rent to just allow them to kind of get out. They didn't want to go to shelter necessarily. They didn't want to get a restraining order. They didn't want to get the guy deported. They just needed financial security. So that's one thing. The second thing we heard overwhelmingly is prevention. That prevention has been underemphasized, underfunded, underappreciated, underresearched. And so we need more research dollars. We need more both federal, state, and philanthropic and institutional money towards prevention. That means education programs, you know, for younger kids and as well as kind of young adults. That means workplace prevention programs and trainings. And it means culture change. And that's something that President Biden cares deeply about is kind of, as he says, changing the culture in order to shift social norms so that we don't see this as part of the fabric of our society that we have to kind of accept and push against, but it becomes unacceptable.
Well, there's a reason that the chick song Earl's Gotta Die has like stayed on the top of the charts. Well, I have two questions before we leave. I wanted to just ask you a little about Jessica Lanningham. Was that kind of the start of your interest in this subject? And if you could just give us like a quick, who is Jessica Lanningham? What happened to her? But that's kind of been my connection with you for 15, 18 years.
Yeah. Jessica Lanningham is an incredible human being. She, amongst many other things, is a survivor of domestic violence. And she has been my client and my colleague and a mentor to me in many ways over the past 20 years, really since I was a baby lawyer. I got to know her. I was I just started a fellowship at the ACLU Women's Rights Project, and her case had just been accepted by the U.S. Supreme Court. Her case was a little known case, and it wasn't on the radar of most of the major civil rights and human rights organizations. And then all of a sudden, when it was accepted by the Supreme Court, everyone realized this was the next major women's rights case. It was a case, and just kind of warning to your listeners, this is involves some tragic set of facts, but it was a case involving Jessica, who got a restraining order against her estranged husband after he had exhibited threats and threatening behavior in the process of a divorce they were getting. And the judge prohibited him through the restraining order from having contact with her and her girls. And he kidnapped the kids in violation of the order. This was in Castle Rock, Colorado, around 40 minutes outside of Denver. He drove around with the kids for almost 10 hours while she had 9 points of contact with the police, showing them the restraining order. Colorado is a mandatory arrest state, which means it was supposed to remove the police discretion about whether to arrest or not to arrest. They shall arrest under Colorado law. Mm-hmm. Well, sadly, the police did nothing. They looked for a lost dog. They went to dinner. They did paperwork. They did not look for those girls, those missing children. They acted on assumptions about Jessica and her trustworthiness and her credibility, the same things that are discussed in the article you mentioned from the Washington Post. And then tragically, Simon Gonzalez, her estranged husband, showed up at the police station at 3 a.m. and he opened fire with a gun he purchased that evening. And the police shot and killed him, and then tragically found the bodies of the three daughters dead inside his car. And so Jessica sued the police, saying, "It's my constitutional right for you to respond to my calls for help. How could you not respond under the 14th Amendment, the Due Process Clause, right? Says that, you know, there should be a duty to protect, right, and there should be a police response, and I should get some sort of response to my restraining order that is validated by Colorado's mandatory arrest law."
Right.
But the Supreme Court found against Jessica. They found she had no constitutional right to have her restraining order enforced. And it was then that Jessica and her mom came to us at ACLU and said, someone's got to hold the United States government responsible for this. This ruling sends a message to the entire country that restraining orders aren't worth the piece of paper they're printed on. Mm-hmm. And so it was really on the kind of inspiration and urging of Jessica and her mother that a group of lawyers at the ACLU, we put our heads together and thought, oh, let's take this case to the international human rights community and let's shine a light on this this issue and the United States being out of step with world practice and mm-hmm. world opinion on what constitutes a duty to protect survivors of domestic violence, especially when the government knows that they're specifically in danger and gives them a piece of paper that says we will protect you. Mm-hmm. So that's how I got that's really how I cut my teeth on this work. And that was in 2004, 20 okay. years ago.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay. There's some very, very recent news. Can we talk about that in closing?
Sure. Yes. The Federal Communications Commission, the FCC chair, just attended an oversight hearing where she is arguing that technology facilitated stalking with car GPS systems should be taken up by car companies, that there should be ways in which if an abusive partner is stalking a victim through the use of this new GPS technology or other, you know, technologies that allow car doors to be opened or cars to be locked or unlocked or started or, you know, not able to start, that this is a form of technology facilitated abuse that uses the same control tactics that abusers have always used, but through new technological means. And so she's arguing that car companies need to take this up. Apparently, within recent years, the cell phone companies have done the same thing. And if a victim or survivor comes with an order of protection, for example, the cell phone companies have now disconnected the accounts, for example, if there's a shared account between married people, so that the, you know, the abusive partner doesn't have access to the victim's account and can't track her whereabouts and can't know where she is and can't stalk her and can't mess with her. And so that's kind of the latest frontier for the FCC. It's really important. It's really interesting and exciting. And it's actually, very, very meaningful because this really kind of combines two major focus areas that I've been involved with as we created this U.S. national plan to end gender-based violence that was released last year by the White House. One of the pillars focuses on economic abuse, and one of the pillars focuses on technology-facilitated gender-based violence. This is the nexus of those two things. Mm-hmm. This is where people are controlling kind of the economic livelihood and also just kind of the ability to live in the world, mm-hmm. right? One's ability to be free and be well and be safe, and using technology to do that. The FCC chair is kind of saying car companies, first and foremost, have a responsibility to figure this out. Mm-hmm. And there's some anecdotes about Tesla in particular, kind of not fully showing a comprehensive understanding
right.
of the realities for domestic violence survivors.
But Toyota,
it looks like, you know, is one step ahead. So good thing I have a Toyota.
Yeah, there you go. Well, hope that's not the right reason you have a Toyota. Well, this has been great. Correct. I really appreciate your time and energy. Yay, I finally got you on the show.
Yay, it's great to be here.
Well, nice seeing you.
Look forward to next time.
Yep. See you around.
Thanks for joining us for The Explainer and a whole new season of Explaining. If you enjoy our show, leave us a 5-star review with your podcast provider and ask your friends to subscribe. Our show is engineered and edited by Christopher Alzadi with theme music composed by Rady Kim from the Frost School of Music. I'm your host, Annette Ugas. Today's show was brought to you by Miami Law's 41st Annual Lawyer of the Americas Banquet, Thursday, March 21st on the Coral Gables campus. For more information, visit www.law.miami.edu.